Welcome to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, here's your host, Jason Miller.
Welcome to the program. Today is a special edition of Ask the CIO. We're talking to a different kind of CIO, a Chief Innovation Officer. Chris Gerdes is the Chief Innovation Officer at the Transportation Department.
You have a very interesting title. You're a CIO of a different sort, a Chief Innovation Officer. Talk about that role at the Transportation Department and give me a little sense of is this a new role, not just for you, but for the Transportation Department as well?
This is a new role, so I'm lucky to serve as the first Chief Innovation Officer at the U.S. Department of Transportation. This year is something of a prototype, so what I'm trying to do is to figure out how best to utilize that role and leave a playbook for following Chief Innovation Officers. In general, the role has three aspects. The first is really to help foster the culture of innovation within the department. DOT has a phenomenal number of really innovative people, and trying to shine a spotlight on them and give them the support that they need to really make a difference is a part of the role. The second is to look at the barriers to innovation. What are the things that prevent us from harnessing all of the capabilities of an organization, and how do we reduce those? And then the third is really looking outside. In transportation, there's an awful lot of good innovation going on in the private sector and other government agencies that can really foster the DOT's mission. So what can we do to really enhance that and make sure that the future transportation system develops in a way that really serves all the people?
I definitely want to get to that third role about the transportation system, but let me back up for a sec. Interesting, whenever I talk to CIOs, it's obviously the Chief Information Officer, Richard McKinney at DOT, who you probably know very well. I've talked to him several times. When you come in as being the other CIO, what does that mean? Do you have to explain what you do, why you're here, or do people get it once they see the title Chief Innovation Officer?
Well, it's interesting. I actually thought I was going to have to spend a lot more time explaining what I do than I have. I think going throughout the department with that title, people who are interested in doing things in different ways, people who have new ideas, who are looking for support, kind of come out of the woodwork. And so I've had a lot of people come up and introduce themselves to me, want to get involved, want to understand what it is that I'm doing. And so I've found that it hasn't actually been that necessary to define the role. Basically, I'm here to help. And I've been doing a number of workshops. It comes naturally to me. My usual job is as a professor at Stanford University. So here for a year, the teaching side comes naturally. So I've been giving some workshops on innovation tools for idea generation and then how to build from that into prototypes. And my workshops come with a warranty. I've told people, if you want help in implementing these, in using these ideas in your job, give me a call. So people have, and I've gotten to get engaged with a lot of great people on a variety of topics across the modes.
How'd you end up coming here from Stanford? Was it a call from Secretary Fox? Give me a sense of, because it's maybe an unusual, number one, to be a new position, like a CIO in your case, but two, usually don't get a lot of academics coming to do something like your role. They may come and work in a research and development area, but not necessarily an innovation area.
My simple answer is they asked. And I think, honestly, that's a good lesson for government. I think a lot of people would be interested in coming and helping if they were simply asked. So there was an initial contact actually from the White House Personnel Office that then put me in touch with Secretary Fox and with Mark Dowd, his senior advisor. And we had some discussions about this. And I asked, would there be an opportunity to make an impact? Because I said I wanted to do things that were important. I had a chance to do that in my lab at Stanford. So would I really be able to do something at DOT? And Secretary Fox convinced me. He said, you would be surprised at what sort of an impact that you can have. So I really couldn't turn down that offer to come and do this.
And you hear that from a lot of people, is that when you're asked to serve, if you will, it's such an incredible experience, opportunity, because you can make an impact in such a big way. So you talked about workshops you're giving, you talked about opening the door to innovation at DOT. Talk a little about some of the things you've been doing over the last few months.
My background from a technical standpoint is really in automated vehicles. So I've been working in automated vehicles for almost 25 years now. And one of the activities we have going on in the department is through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. They're looking at how we can get automated vehicles on the road safely. And this involves a number of aspects, developing operational deployment guidelines for companies that would like to deploy, also working with the states to figure out the state role and the federal role with this. So the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has been doing a great job with this and has engaged me to help in that process. And so that's one of the activities that I've enjoyed a lot, is sort of being part of the conversations that are going on among many stakeholders to try to make sure that these technologies do get out quickly but safely.
So when you work with another part of DOT, whether in this case the National Transportation Safety Board, talk a little bit about what you do as the Chief Innovation Officer. You talked about workshops earlier, but that could be more general. Or do you kind of sit down and help them kind of, okay, where do you want to be? How do you get there? Where does innovation play a role? Talk about where you fit into that discussion.
One of the things that people often say when I talk to them is, I used to feel like I was more creative as a kid, but I'm not that creative now. I don't think that's actually true. It's just that as our brains develop, we become very good at seeing particular patterns. And those people who've been successful in government service have been very good at seeing patterns and seeing the ways of doing things according to the usual system. So what it really requires to develop new ideas is to think in a different manner, to get outside of the usual patterns. And there's a few ways of doing this, a few ways of listening to other people or just reframing problems or questions to get a different perspective. And so one of the things I've been doing is trying to coach people through some of those techniques to look at problems a little bit differently and get a few insights. When you're dealing with phenomenally intelligent people who really care about the things that they're trying to solve and have been looking at them for a number of years, it often doesn't take much to simply get them thinking in a slightly different way, and then they come up with ideas on their own.
Give me a sense of something maybe that you're working on right now, a project or a program where you're starting to see some fruits of that approach.
Well, so one of the things that I've been talking to people about is simply to look past some of the constraints that exist. There obviously are a lot of constraints when it comes to working in government, and they're much more pronounced in many ways than they are in my experience working with a startup company working at the university. But there's still a lot of things that people can do. And so one of the challenges that I see is that a lot of the constraints are, in fact, laws. And breaking the law is scary. It's not something that you should do. So there tends to be this tendency to, in some ways, exaggerate the constraints. As it's almost like a game of telephone, as people try to explain from one level to the next what can be done. It gets slightly more conservative at every level until people often get the idea of, well, I can't do anything. Well, that's not actually true. And so a lot of times a technique that I find to be really useful is to say, okay, well, what if I didn't have any of these constraints? What is it that I would really like to accomplish? It gets people thinking past the constraints long enough to think about what the outcome could be. And then you start to add the constraints back in and say, well, what's reasonable? Maybe some of these solutions aren't, but maybe there's aspects of this that I really can take into my daily life. And so that's one particular technique. Another one is just to think about what you want the outcome to be and work your way backwards. And I've done that with a couple of groups looking at research. So if you sort of set, what are the goals of your research? What would you like to have accomplished? Great, it's 20 years from now, you've accomplished that. You've accomplished it perfectly. How did you get there? And what that does is it just sort of gets people thinking a little bit differently about where are the high value things that I can do today to get where I want to go in the future. That may be a little bit different than, you know, providing an incremental change of funding to this activity or that activity.
A lot of times the government gets a bad rap of the people inside the government that they can't be innovative. Today, this is the way it worked today. This is the way it will work tomorrow. This is the way it will work in a year from now. But it sounds like you're starting to get people to kind of think that a little differently. Are you finding it as challenging, more challenging, less challenging than when you came in saying, hey, how do we get these federal employees to think in an innovative way? What kind of expectation did you have?
Actually, it is very different than I expected. When I came in, I had heard from a lot of people, you need to get people in the Department of Transportation to think as innovators and to be innovators. As I came in, I realized that there were a lot of people who really felt of them that way about themselves, that were really good at creating innovative ideas. And what they really needed was some encouragement and to be used as an example for other people. So that's been a really pleasant surprise in some ways. I think there's plenty of innovation in the department. The question is really how to connect the dots, how to grow that, how to use examples that may come up from one mode of transportation and use that to inspire innovation in other modes of transportation. Having the freedom to go throughout the entire department and the charter to really think across the department has given me the opportunity to do that. Oftentimes somebody will ask me a question about how would I think about this particular data use that somebody else has been struggling with or maybe even has come up with a good solution for in another part of the department. And so that's been a fun aspect of the job, is really supporting the existing innovators and connecting them with other people.
And that actually was going to be part of my next question, was that connection, because the role that you sit in, again, Chief Innovation Officer, you can say, well, I'm working with this modal here and I'm working with that modal here, and wow, if I brought them together, the end result could be even greater. Is that part of your role as well, is to play that conduit of innovation, of ideas, of opportunity?
Yes, exactly. That's one of the things that I am very focused on, because each of the modes and have very demanding day-to-day jobs. If you look at it, what the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration or the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, Federal Transit Administration are trying to accomplish are really difficult tasks. And there tends to be a focus on day-to-day operations because they are so important and so pressing. So it's nice to be somebody in the department with a slightly different mandate. Instead of focusing on those day-to-day operations, it really is making these connections, helping to facilitate innovation, and seeing where the opportunities are to do even better at some of this. So that's been a role that I've greatly enjoyed.
We have to take a break. My guest is Chris Gerdes, the Chief Innovation Officer at the Transportation Department. I'm your host, Jason Miller.
You're listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions. Once again, here's your host, Jason Miller.
Welcome back. My guest today is Chris Gerdes, the Chief Innovation Officer at the Transportation Department. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and this is a special edition of Ask the CIO, where we're talking about innovation.
You mentioned earlier, not only are you the first Chief Innovation Officer, in some ways you're the pilot program to see if this could extend on beyond yourself and other people maybe would step into the role. Do you have end goals? When you leave after your term here at the Transportation Department, do you say, I want to get this, that, and the other thing accomplished? Or how do you know that you've, if you will, made a difference?
So there are certain projects within the modes that I'm working with, and I'm very enthusiastic to see how those go. And I'm convinced that the people who I'm working with will actually carry forward those ideas. On a larger scale, we're also talking about training the trainers, creating other people who have the ability to train others and to facilitate some of these idea generation, prototyping processes. And so there's a lot of enthusiasm for that. As a teacher, that's a role that seems quite natural to me. And I've found so many people interested in wanting to acquire more of these skills and the ability to teach them to others, together with their own experiences, not just copying things that have worked for me, but really internalizing, figuring out what works for them in their day-to-day jobs, and then being able to encourage other people. So I'm hoping that by the end of my time here, some of this has gone viral in the Department of Transportation, that we have fairly widespread support, that within different modes, within different offices, there are individual innovation champions who can really help other people through this.
And you mentioned the setting up of a potential playbook, or leave some kind of playbook so people can follow. Okay, if I want to be more innovative, what are some of the steps I can take to get there? Is that something that you're working on? Is that something you're working more broadly beyond DOT with? Because beyond one agency, every agency could probably use that help to be more innovative.
I think there's a lot of opportunity also to think about this across government. So I think Tom Khalil at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy has been doing a lot of work with innovation across the department. I just met with the innovation team at the Peace Corps and saw what they were doing, and we were comparing notes. So I think there would be a lot of opportunities to do this across government. It's an interesting role because, in my mind, innovation is really different from research. I come from a research and technology standpoint, but innovation really is about applying your creativity to come up with unique solutions. And that bar being set fairly high, that we're trying to do things that have never been done before. Well, that can apply to any realm. It can apply to research, to policy, to acquisition, to a number of different government roles. And so in the future, I could see the Chief Innovation Officer coming from a number of backgrounds. Maybe it's somebody who's played that role in a state or local government. Maybe it's somebody coming over who's had experience in other agencies. Maybe it is somebody coming in from some aspect of academics. And so I think it is an interesting role, and I'd love to help shape that and provide some support for the next person to come in.
You mentioned sometimes people look at certain laws and as an inhibitor to innovation. Are you finding other roadblocks or other inhibitors that maybe are easily removed?
I think it's really important to figure out where rules come from. So they could be congressional mandates, which are very, very hard to change. They could be things that were deliberately considered and thoughtfully enacted, or it could be that this was simply the way that things have been done for 20 years and people hadn't really questioned it. So it's important to know where the constraints come from, how serious are they, and when it makes sense to really start this questioning process. There's obviously some things that you want to do in a systematic way, such as hiring people, onboarding. You don't want to reinvent the wheel every time. But there's other things, such as the rulemaking process, that you may want to revisit in certain cases. NHTSA has done this with automated vehicles. Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration has been looking at a lot of cooperative rulemaking and partnerships to enhance how they do their job. So these are some good examples of innovative thinking and saying, well, all right, maybe there are some other approaches. What's good is to have a necessity for that, to have a problem that you're really trying to solve, and then that motivates new ways of thinking around it.
Do you feel like that most of the roadblocks to innovation is just the culture issue? People just have to retrain themselves to think differently? I mean, of course, there will be policy laws and regulations, but generally speaking, a lot of people talk about acquisition in the government and the federal acquisition regulation, something that you may or may not ever have to deal with. But they always talk about, well, if it's not in the FAR, that means you can do it. If it's not prohibited, that means you can. Do you find innovations is the same way? If there's no laws against it, you just have to kind of get your mind around the fact that you can do it?
I think that's exactly right, that there are a number of ways in which you really can move quickly with innovation. But it's important to acknowledge that our government is deliberately set up so that people cannot always move quickly in the directions that they want to move. So there's just some design issues to that. What I think is important is to help people work through where are the real constraints and where are the places where there's nothing preventing us from trying new ideas, for moving quickly, and encouraging people to really spend a lot of their time and focus on those.
When you hear about innovation throughout the government, a lot of people focus on digital services and the digital services groups that are popping up across government. Obviously, the U.S. Digital Service in the White House. Are you working closely with the Transportation Department's digital services group?
Yes, absolutely. What I've found is it's incredibly important to build a network or community of practice around innovation. And so if you look at the Chief Information Officer's office, Richard McKinney and his team are doing a great job in this. Maria Rote, our chief technology officer, is a fantastic example. When I first met her, the expression that she used was build what other people are talking about. And I can't think of another phrase that better exemplifies this idea of prototyping. Don't try to predict what the future is going to be, but jump in and discover it. Actually try these sorts of things. And so I think Maria is a fantastic example of somebody who really is working in an innovative manner, who's taking that first step. And where my role kind of intersects is to try to make sure that the work that she's doing is recognized throughout the department, and the prototypes that she's doing can get leveraged across the modes to really make a huge difference.
And what you're talking about there, to some extent, is the new virtual sandbox that they set up in the cloud, two different clouds that allow people to come in and try things out. It's early. I know they just set it up, but is this something that's in your plans as you work with the different modals?
This is one of the things that I'm encouraging people to take part in, because one of the conversation topics that comes up in, I would say, at least half of the conversations is how do we make better use of data? And there are challenges. There are acquisition challenges that Maria had to go through in order to get this set up. But having run that gauntlet already and set it up, it is a great opportunity for people to come in and over a very short period of time, come in with a hypothesis, come in with a data set, and test these sorts of things out. So I think that's a great example. And I think it's the solution to some of the problems that people are having throughout the modes.
Chris, this has been a fascinating conversation. Other agencies may be listening and going, okay, well, that's transportation. We can't do that. What kind of advice do you give to other agencies to say, you can be innovative and here's where you start, or here's where you need to start to think about?
Well, I think innovation is somewhat of an overused buzzword these days, to be perfectly honest. But I think it's a very real concept. It's the idea of coming up with unique solutions to difficult problems. And the role that government faces is challenging. The public expects some unique solutions. So I think there is definitely a role for a chief innovation officer. I think if it is important to the agency to generate these new ideas, to really have the stamina to kind of keep going. Sometimes creativity, I think of, is actually a lot of hard work. It's not just being clever. It really is having the diligence and the determination to keep going until you can reach new solutions and then bring those into practice. And it's great to have somebody who's focused primarily on that. I think one of the key aspects of innovation is if it's going to be important, it needs to be part of the job. You can have somebody responsible for it in the organization. It needs to be a part of the job requirements and evaluation for the people who you want to engage in these sorts of innovative thinking and innovative projects. If you ask for it, you'll get it. And if you don't, then you probably won't.
Chris Gerdes is the Chief Innovation Officer, a different type of CIO for the Transportation Department. Chris, thanks for taking the time to join me.
Absolutely, Jason. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions. Once again, here's your host, Jason Miller.
Welcome back. In this part of the show, we switch gears a bit to talk about innovation of a different kind. Julie Schneider is the program director of the Entrepreneur in Residence Program at the Department of Health and Human Services. I'm your host, Jason Miller.
Julie, this is a little different from my show, so welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So the Entrepreneur in Residence Program, let's talk at the very beginning. What is it? How does it work? And how long it's been going on? Just give me a little bit of background.
It was launched in 2012 by our first Chief Technology Officer, Todd Park. And the idea behind the program is really to bring entrepreneurs and innovators into the government for defined tours of duty to help us with some of our toughest and most challenging problems. So far, we've hired 21 entrepreneurs in residence to come work with 53 intrapreneurs, so existing career federal staff who really have these project ideas and really want outside input from these entrepreneurs. And they've worked all across the Department of Health and Human Services in different components, 10 different components. So the program really has two major goals. First is to really help internal teams test out new approaches to complete some of these challenging projects. So really in a situation where they have a project, they have an idea, they want to maybe do it in a slightly different way, and they know they're missing a critical skill set on their team. So we hope that bringing these entrepreneurs in to help them will help them do that. And then also kind of a broader goal is that by having these entrepreneurs come and embed themselves with these internal teams, we hope that they're going to kind of help create a culture of innovation within HHS. So not only will their presence for that year help them with that project, but we hope that the internal group that's working with that entrepreneur is going to go on and use some of those methodologies and approaches for subsequent and future projects.
You said 21 entrepreneurs, 53 intrapreneurs,
yep,
across 10 different components, a couple, yep, numbers to just to repeat there. How does it work? Does somebody apply for an entrepreneur in residence? Hey, I'm on this project and I need help, and here's my, if you will, business case.
We actually start with the project ideas. So we do a department-wide competition for project ideas from internal staff, and we review them at HHS Idea Lab, and we really look for three major things. First, we want to know that it's an important project, potentially very impactful. Second of all, we want to know that the internal team is really missing a skill set. They know what that skill set is, and they kind of know how this person is going to fit into their team. And then finally, we really look at the internal team to make sure that they are a group of creative problem solvers that are really genuinely looking for new ideas, because we want these folks to come in and push the envelope a little bit. And we want to make sure that, you know, we know there's going to be tension, but at core, we want to know that that internal team is kind of ready for that and excited for that.
In many ways, what you're doing is asking someone to come in and disrupt the normal way of business. And if you have a team who's like, well, we've done this 13 years in a row the same way every year, so we just need somebody to come in and help us go for a 14th year, that probably isn't the right type of group that you're looking to bring in someone like this.
Absolutely right.
And give me a sense, because it started when, and then how did it start? Did someone come up with this idea to do this, or did it grow out of the Idea Lab?
It was our first Chief Technology Officer who had this idea, and I think it was really looking across the organization, and we realized that we've got great problems that really attract entrepreneurs, that are exciting to entrepreneurs, but I think we've got great problems. We know we're missing some particular skill sets. So a lot of our projects either focus in IT modernization, data science, and process improvement. If I had to name three areas, that's an area where we have a lot of challenging problems and we really need those skill sets. But we also kind of wanted to make a program that was attractive for people who normally wouldn't be interested in working in government to come in and do that. So I think those are really the major reasons why the program was started.
And obviously Todd Park, who went on to become the federal CTO, is still working closely with some of the recruitment of tech talent for the administration. I want to go through some of the projects, but before we do that, let me maybe start on the back end and say, I know that you had two recent programs looking for entrepreneurs and residents at the FDA and the CDC. Discuss what they're looking for, what those projects are.
Actually, FDA and CDC, we just had our entrepreneurs and residents come on board. But we do have two other projects that I'd like to talk about really briefly that we are currently looking for people. So they're both really exciting projects. The first one is within the HHS Office of Civil Rights. And what they're really looking for is a process improvement, a continuous improvement expert who can come in for a year and help them reimagine their system for intake of customer complaints. So they get about 24,000 complaints each year from the general public in a few major areas. So privacy breaches, access to medical records, and civil rights issues within healthcare institutions. And what they really want to do is they have an increasing number of complaints. They really want someone to come in and help them look about how they can resolve those complaints more quickly and more effectively. The second opportunity is within CMS, within the group that runs the Medicaid program. And what they're really doing is they are looking to try to lower the barriers for entry for small tech companies that want to bid on state Medicaid IT contracts. So currently, they're kind of a relatively small number of larger companies that tend to do this work, but CMS knows there are a lot of really exciting technologies and ideas out there within smaller companies. So they want someone to come in who can really help them understand what the pain points are for those types of companies and kind of design a system moving forward where they can encourage more of these small players to come into the space.
How does that process work? Do they put a job announcement out and see who applies? Do you go recruit specific types of people? Give me a sense of how the process works.
And I think that's where IdeaLab really adds some value, because we do different types of approaches to typical federal hiring, because these are people that don't normally come to USA Jobs. They're not normally interested in working for the government, so we have to kind of meet them where they are. And I think that's where our current chief technology officer, Susanna Fox, has done a great job in terms of being an ambassador to that tech world and the entrepreneur world. So part of it is, you know, her efforts going to various meetings and being in that community and kind of talking about the really exciting problems that we have and our need for these types of skill sets. But we also use other approaches, like we do a lot of social media outreach, and that has been very effective for us. Certainly since the program's been around for a few years, our alumni network is a huge source of referrals. They do some of that through just their own personal in-person outreach and some through social media as well. So we do that. We help to kind of bring these candidates in, but then we work really collaboratively again with the project teams to interview them and review them. So we have some input at IdeaLab in terms of what the entrepreneurial or innovative potential is, but ultimately it's really the project team that has to be comfortable in terms of selecting that person. The other thing that we do at the IdeaLab is we help with the onboarding process, because you might imagine for entrepreneurs and innovators who don't have any government experience, the government hiring process is a bit intimidating. So that's part of my role, to interface with the various HR departments in the components of HHS that are bringing these folks on, and to work with the entrepreneurs as well to, you know, help them kind of understand what our process is. And I think we've made a lot of progress in partnership with our HR colleagues to, you know, make this smooth and get people on as quickly as possible, which is important since we're really only bringing them on initially for about a year.
And that was actually my next question. Are they coming on under Schedule A hiring authority? And then is there a way that you're getting through the process more quickly? Because as you know, you could say, well, we found somebody, they're perfect, but if it takes 6 or 9 months to bring them in, they have another job already.
Absolutely. So it is the Schedule A Part R authority that we've primarily been using to bring these folks in. And again, that's been part of my role. You know, as soon as we accept one of these projects, for the program. My role is to reach out to the partner HR organization and to start the dialogue. Make sure that they know about Schedule A. We've had a lot of support here centrally at HHS doing education and outreach about this authority and that the different components of HHS can use it. So we start that dialogue early and we really try to explain we're really looking at a different type of candidate pool, as you said, who's not used to having to wait a long time to get on board. So we try to front load a lot of those discussions and really keep them in the loop every step of the way as we're doing this recruitment process. And they also understand this is really a HHS level priority with the chief technology officer. So they really work with us to, when the time comes, to get these folks onboarded as quickly as possible.
Typically speaking, how long does it take? Are you talking about 30 days, 45 days to get someone on, or even sooner?
It varies, and sometimes it depends on the candidate, right, and their availability to come on board. But yeah, I think from the time that the groups identify someone, we're really looking between, 30 and 60 days to get people on. But, it can vary a little bit, and sometimes, again, it's because of the preference of the candidate.
And again, typically when you look across all the 21 different entrepreneurs and residents that have come in, where have they come from? What's their background?
It's really a range. A lot of the folks we bring in really are mid to senior level folks who have had a really interesting careers. They're often serial entrepreneurs themselves, but they've really come to a point in their career where they want to give back. They want to use their skills. They're very attracted to the idea of public service and also kind of the national or sometimes international significance of the projects that we work on at HHS. So it is a range, but we definitely have a number of mid to senior level folks. I would say, yeah, almost all the people that we've hired have been from the private sector. Some are serial entrepreneurs. Some have worked in larger companies and have decided to leave those positions to come and work with us at HHS. I think we really do benefit from having a very compelling mission, and that's often what attracts these folks to come and work with us.
We have to take a break. My guest today is Julie Schneider, the program director of the Entrepreneur in Residence program at the Department of Health and Human Services. I'm your host, Jason Miller.
You're listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions. Once again, here's your host, Jason Miller.
Welcome back. My guest today is Julie Schneider, the program director of the Entrepreneur in Residence program at the Department of Health and Human Services. I'm your host, Jason Miller.
What's the biggest adjustment for these entrepreneurs as they come in? Because if they're used to saying, if they're serial startups, they're used to being one in charge, and two, they're used to getting things done very quickly because they're serial, right? They want to move on to the next thing. So what's been the biggest challenge of the adjustment?
So there are definitely challenges and adjustments there, but from my perspective of someone who's been in the government for a while, that's one of the really exciting parts of the program, right? Is to see that give and take, that push and pull. So I think we really see our internal project team is just so invaluable. So these entrepreneurs and residents, they come in, they have all sorts of exciting ideas, but they need that guidance and input from the internal staff to help make that real within government. So, I think there are a number of challenges, especially for the developers. This whole idea of moving to more agile development as opposed to waterfall development is a big issue. They're also very often complicated review boards when they're moving from a prototype that they've developed to try to actually integrate that into the system. So that is challenging.
You've been nice. You haven't said the procurement process. You haven't said the challenges with budget. But those are typical. I mean, I guess. Coming into certain jobs, there's some bureaucracy, for lack of a better word, that you're going to have to deal with. But a lot of times, you still have this inertia that you're fighting in the uphill battle. I mean, do they seem to understand the inertia, I think, is probably the biggest piece. This is the way we've always done it. And it's like, no, but we need you to think differently. And even if the people, as you said from the beginning of the conversation, the group is willing to think differently, it's sometimes hard to change.
Yeah, and I think that what's so great about this program is the mutual understanding on both sides. So the internal folks, it's a glimpse to the outside world and how things are done now, outside of the government. And that's really exciting and energizing, to the right group of people. I think the flip side is for the entrepreneurs coming in, they develop an understanding of often how difficult it is for us inside to push change because of a lot of the red tape, because of a lot of bureaucracy. And I think, yeah, there's really, when this is working well, there's really a mutual understanding there that I think benefits everyone in terms of thinking about how can we really move the needle forward given the constraints that we have in the government environment.
Generally speaking, have most of the entrepreneurs lasted? Have they come in and 3 months in, it's come to you and be like, you know, Julie, thanks, but this isn't working. I got to go do something else. Or have most at least stuck it out the first year and made change, even if it's, again, incremental change or small amounts of change? Everything helps a little bit, moves the ball forward.
Most have stayed, at least for their year. And about, actually, one measure of success that we use for the program is about half get asked to stay longer. Some, there's actually one entrepreneur from the initial class who's still here, and the agency has actually kind of built a larger program around that individual. So for the most part, yeah, they stay, and at least half of them get asked to stay longer.
And with Schedule A, I think you can extend at least another year or more. Is that the way, if I understand the authority right?
Up to 4 years.
Let's shift. We've talked a lot about the people and the projects. Let's talk more specifically about what the impact they're having. If you want to maybe give us some examples over some of the projects that you've had entrepreneur in residences participate in, and what changes have they brought?
Project from our initial round, which was at our Health Resources and Services Administration. They run the National Organ Transplantation System. And they came to us with this project idea because they really wanted to address the fact that they were tracking organ procurements using pen and paper. So on average for each organ procurement, there were somewhere between 30 and 70 handwritten labels that were being made. So what we helped them do is to attract and onboard a wonderful entrepreneur in residence who was not a health expert but had a whole career in supply chain logistics. So he had worked at the United Parcel Service for about 20 years. And so he came in and was within 4 months, he had developed a prototype, including a handheld barcoder, scanner, and printer, and started testing it and rolling it out in the organ procurement sites across the country. He did a lot of work in addition to the technology in terms of really doing a deep dive to understand the processes within each organ procurement center, because he knew right off the bat that in order to maximize the acceptance, the chance that the technology would be accepted, he had to really understand what the current state of the processes were in each of these organizations so that it wouldn't be too hard for them to accept this technology. And I'm really happy to say that between 2014 and 2015, about 5,000 organs had been collected using this new technology, and system-wide deployment is expected by 2017.
And you think something so important would have been automated years ago, but the fact is they're dependent on labels and pen and paper. The person who had worked at UPS probably walked in and said, "You're kidding me. Like UPS, we're shipping, you know, shoes and clothes and toys much more efficiently than you guys are doing something that's life dependent." So as it's been rolling out, was this a project that was brought to the Idea Lab saying we need help with it, we got to get off this pen and paper? Or was this something where the secretary or the deputy secretary saw it very similar to what we see, for instance, at the Patent and Trademark Office, where someone just said, "Well, our patent and trademark systems just aren't working, we got to improve it"? Like how did that come to B.
We use a very bottom-up approach. We go out to our operating divisions and ask them what are their problems. I think that's an important philosophy for us. We feel that the folks closest to the problems understand the problems and also the willingness to change, the readiness to change much better than we can here. So our role is really to look at what's submitted to us and say, wow, that, you know, there's clearly with that project, there was a major change for impact. And yeah, I think it was very energizing for that entrepreneur in residence to come in and be able to make such a big impact, to use his skills in that completely different way and really have a major impact on a program of national significance.
It's a great example of the organ donation program. Are there other examples you could provide that maybe you thought you'd go down a certain path and it went down a different path, or you thought you'd get one result and once the entrepreneur in residence came in, they took a different approach in this, so therefore you got a different result. I mean, these things happen all the time. We know it's tech, so there's no assurances unless if you're, you know, doing something that you've done 101 times, which is not the reason why these people come in.
Absolutely. So I would say for every project that we have, that first 3 to 4 months is an exploratory phase. And we really push hard on our internal teams to define their problem, but we also want them to be flexible in terms of what the solution will be. So really, the entrepreneur in residence comes in for that first 3 to 4 month period and spends a lot of time trying to really understand the system, understand the problem, and there's definitely pivoting and changing of scope and direction that happens. One example I would give is that we had a project, again, in our first round where CMS and ONC brought in a lean processing expert to look specifically at the process for developing electronic clinical quality measures, which are really important, as you might imagine, for measuring impact of the Affordable Care Act. And so she went in using her lean process skills to really convene all the stakeholders and really map out the current state, think about what the future state would be, and help get them kind of on a path to moving towards that future state. But what she found very quickly is once people realized her skill set and what she was doing for that project, she got pulled into all sorts of other potential process improvement projects within CMS. And so I think in that case, she did do the initial project. She's actually still around 3 years later because people realized what a valuable skill set she had and started asking for her help to improve processes in several other areas of the agency.
That's a great testament of skills and the need for these types of skills. Two, I imagine it's part of how you measure the progress or measure the success of the Entrepreneur in Residence program. Number one, I guess, do they meet their initial goals of what they're trying to do for the program? Two, are they asked to stay longer? How else do you measure success of the program?
We're really focused on the quality of the projects, the quality of the results. And so some of the ways that we think about success, I think a really important one is, did we actually solve the problem in a new way? Did we do something that wasn't business as usual? And I think that's a resounding yes with these incredibly creative and energetic people from the outside who come in. Another thing we really look at is customer satisfaction. So customers, in a way, are we think of as our internal project team. So we certainly, I go to them on a regular basis, a monthly, quarterly basis, to ask for their input about how is the project going. So we've had cases where one entrepreneur in residence was hired, and then, you know, 6 months, 9 months later, can we have another one, you know, to further build out this project. So that's through that process of going back to the internal teams and asking them how we're doing. I think I mentioned that we think one measure of success is about half of our entrepreneurs are asked to stay beyond their initial 13-month period. Some of our entrepreneurs have gotten external funding to expand and continue their projects. We also see repeat applications from project teams who want, you know, to do another project with us because they had such a great experience with their first entrepreneur in residence. And, you know, we definitely track case studies and success stories like the organ transplantation story and the lean process story that we talked about earlier.
Julie, this was a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate your time, but unfortunately we are out of time. My guest is Julie Schneider, the director of the Department of Health and Human Services Entrepreneur in Residence Program. Julie, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Oracle and DLT Solutions. The entire show is available on demand on federalnewsradio.com. Search Ask the CIO.